if you go outside the zone of what you know and what you grew up in this little tiny whatever bubble you're in, you burst the bubble and really go outside it, you're going to enrich yourself and your art and life, really.
Conversation today takes us further into the creative process across different mediums. If you're a fan of Yellowstone, Crazy Rich Asians, Iron Man 3, or the recent Mario Brothers movie, then chances are good that one of the soundtrack's clips we just played is familiar to you. And today on Design Better, we speak with the person behind them all, Emmy Award nominated composer Brian Tyler.
We talk with Brian about his childhood influences, what it was like growing up in a musical family, and how he finds the starting threads of a score. This is Design Better, where we explore creativity at the intersection of design and technology. I'm Aaron Walter.
And I'm Eli Woolery. You can get ad-free episodes a week early and get access to our monthly AMAs with big names in design and tech by becoming a DB Plus subscriber. It's also the best way to support the show. Visit designbetter.plus to learn more.
We'll return to the conversation after this quick break. And now, back to the show.
Brian Tyler, welcome to the Design Better podcast.
What is up?
Really good to have you. You've worked on so many inspirational movies, and I'm sure we're going to touch on a bunch of them. Before we do that, though, we just want to kind of understand your journey into music and your childhood influences. I was reading an interview with you, and you mentioned that you were raised in an artistically inclined family, and that your dad's a painter, artist, designer. We certainly have a lot of designers in our audience, as you probably could tell from the name of our show. But maybe talk a little bit about that, like, you know, growing up in that sort of visual realm and how that translated into your musical career.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a multi-generational visual, you know, artistic family, the Tylers. My dad was a painter, everything from abstract to realism to architecture. He ended up being, you know, like a really amazing modern architect out of his art. And then his dad was also architecture, but when he came out of school, it was like, I think it was the year the Great Depression hit or something. So he ended up going into film in terms of art direction. He was doing DeMille films like Ten Commandments and stuff like that. So I grew up, I loved music and I loved to draw, and I would do renderings, and I loved drawing structures and science fiction stuff. But, you know, my grandfather, my dad wasn't in the entertainment industry at all, but my grandfather, who retired, had, you know, he taught me about matte painting and cutting film and lenses and perspective and depth of field and all those things. So that was kind of that side. And then music was something that I just, you know, I really took to. And that was my main drive. And really over time, it became apparent that, you know, the music side of me was not containable. It was just like, you know, I started playing instruments very young. You know, I was like 4 or 5 and playing drums and started playing piano and guitar and just kind of picking up whatever I could. I was doing a lot of multi-track recording, and it was like a cassette thing that you could record yourself and loop it. So I play the drums and I play some synth parts and I play piano. And all the while I was like playing to my dad's records, everything from like King Crimson to Rush and Steely Dan. And I was really into hip hop and got into breakdancing, like popping and locking and stuff like that. And I would do anything to just get a smile on someone's face, you know, like amaze someone. So I like really got into magic too, like close-up magic and card magic. And so if I could play, you know, I loved playing like drum solos like Neil Peart and doing that kind of thing. And I loved playing like Rachmaninoff on the piano and like guitar, same kind of thing. It was like Yngwie Malmsteen and things like that. But at the same time, it was like anything to kind of bring a smile to someone's face. And that really was kind of part of what made me love music so much, because it was this language that I could use that had much more precision than my words. I was a quiet kid. And so when I would want to express myself, the kind of, like I say, even to this day, when I'm trying to explain something or whatever, the emotional resolution on music is far, far greater than words. Then I started writing music, and I would be fascinated with why a chord would kind of sound like one chord would sound kind of sad, but then it wasn't just happy, sad, minor, major. All these other kinds of chords and voicings could precisely hit an emotion that was like 53% joy, but 17% regret, and 9% aspiration, and 3% fear. And like, you know, like in one chord, and they could be communicated beyond cultures and languages. And that's really what got me to where I am. But at the same time, I was in my teens, I started doing like professional gigs playing drums. I was doing session work, playing on records. I started doing like a lot of live gigs, even like going over into Europe when I was like, you know, 14, 15. And then I just kept going, and I was writing this music. You know, I would read science fiction novels and I would write music to it. But this is like since I was like, you know, like 12. The thing was, is I would hear this music in my head that was like orchestral and choir and all this. But I, at the time, there was no way to get that out. It wasn't the technology to create your own orchestra within a computer or anything like that. So I would write things down, and kind of jumping ahead, like the Frank Herbert novels, the Dune novels.
Yeah, yeah.
I was really into those and into Trek and Star Wars and all that in 2001. But those novels, I loved the Dune Messiah and Children of Dune and Dune. But those last two books I felt were so emotionally resonant to. So I wrote all this music. I was like 12 or something like that. And I just kind of tucked it away. And then way later, after I started scoring films, I got a call from a director who was like, hey, Brian, you know, Disney, they're doing this kind of 6-hour miniseries movie for Sci-Fi Channel, Children of Dune, that's Dune Messiah and Children of Dune. And would you be interested in scoring it? And I was like, dude, what? Okay, I've already, not already scored it, but that's been on my mind since I was 12, kind of like trapped inside me. So I went back and I looked at the old sheet music that I wrote for that. And kind of was like as a nod to the dreamer that I was, looking like, I wonder if someday I'll be able to, you know, I ended up using that as the opening salvo for the entire movie that, you know, it's the Czech Philharmonic and just this kind of wild thing. And so like everything is my childhood and growing up and listening to music and playing and reading books and even the artistic side of it and learning about matte paintings and all that got me so interested in film. It like led me inextricably into this path, I think.
Yeah. Hey, Brian, did you know that Hans Zimmer has a very similar story about being connected to those Dune novels?
No, I've never talked to him about it either.
Almost the exact same thing. And so when he got the opportunity to score the HBO series, he was like, I've been connected to and thinking about this story from the beginning. I think it's fascinating. Those stories are big and layered.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like so much of my career has been built around things that outside of the career, I just loved. Like Formula One and NBA were always my favorite sports. And so I ended up composing the Formula One theme. They call me like, you know, have you heard of Formula One? I'm like, what the? You know, I mean, like an obsessive fan. Or I got to be friends for a long time with Kobe Bryant. And we met at a John Williams concert at the Hollywood Bowl. And he is my favorite player. He entered the NBA the same year as I entered film scoring. And we ended up having this camaraderie. When I met him, he's like, I rehabbed my Achilles to two of my scores. One is Iron Man, I believe Now You See Me, the first one. And so I ended up doing his music for his Nike return and all that. I collected Marvel comics growing up and playing Super Mario.
So you've got this very unique childhood, and clearly, like, you have a gift for, like, seeing. You're very curious, and part of it is, like, seeing interesting things in the world, and then there are people who can connect to that and then just keep pulling the thread and keep pulling the thread, and it seems like that's part of who you are, which allows you to pursue different things in such a deep, connected way. What would have happened if you weren't born into the family that you were born into? What would life have been like?
Well, you know, it's interesting because music kind of was something that I found. So probably music, as long as there were instruments around, but it may not have been film. Because the love of film, I remember my grandfather taking me to see like throwback 70 mil prints of movies. And that had a really huge impact. It's funny you should say this. I want to go back to that because for Are We Dreaming, which I am directing and doing the music for, I do the visuals as well. Now I am doing the thing my grandfather did, but on this at a crazy scale where it's like, you know, we're talking about crazy renders and shot in 22 countries and like with, you know, sci-fi and effects and wormholes and ships and worlds where everything's inverted and water is above us. And I'm actually creating those visuals. It's almost like I've done in the last 4 years, done so much of that working on this project that's coming out at the end of the year, that like, if I wanted to switch career and like be actually like a special effects artist, that's actually like, you know, that's how far I've come. That world's crazy. There's a reason why I'm doing it, because I want there to be a 1-to-1 ratio of the music to the visuals and it'd be the same mind doing both. But the thing you're talking about, what if I was born in a different scenario? It's interesting to see, you know, the butterfly effect where one small thing can just lead to a complete change in your life. And all of these things that my dad playing me scores and Prokofiev and John Williams and Maurice Jarre, the Lawrence Arabia score and like all this stuff when I was a kid. My first musical memory being King Crimson and like, you know, kind of progressive music. If he hadn't had this interesting trade where he needed to trade something for speakers he wanted and he ended up with a Ludwig drum kit for like a couple weeks or something that just happened to be around and I was four and I jumped on and then, you know, I'm like, don't take this. You know, all of these things, like, of course, I have no idea. I might be a teacher somewhere. I'm not sure where my personality, I love to teach and I love to impart knowledge and experience. So who knows? But there was a moment that was funny. I just remembered it was really, really impactful. Probably a key moment in my life happened before I was scoring film. I just got out of Harvard and I was in debt and I moved to LA and should give music a go. And it's a tough business. And I was doing all sorts of things, doing gigs and I was even DJing and stuff, but I was trying to like avoid going down the corporate rabbit hole and doing that. But, you know, school debt and it's LA and my car just got broken into and they stole all my DJ gear and my drums and the things and I had to repair my car and blah, 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 you know, all this stuff. And I remember getting this job offer. There's one that was like a corporate one. And at the same time, I had sent a song to a director who wanted it in his movie. And I said, is anyone scoring it? And they're like, well, yeah, I think someone's going to score it. We got this person. And of course, I had no experience. And I was like, and I played this requiem for the director that I had written and I had recorded in Boston. He thought it was amazing, but I had no experience. And I remember it just happens to be on the same Friday at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I got a call from the corporate job saying, hey, you get the gig, you get the job, and you have till 5 o'clock to decide. And then happens to be that I get a call from the producer of this movie, this independent movie. And I was waiting to the last because I did not want to do this job. It would be like, be the worst. But it was always like 4:55 or 4:56, something like that. And it's like, there's 4 minutes left in the day. It's fine. So I get a call from the producer and he says, hey, okay, here's the deal. Director wants you. You have no credits and all this stuff. And we are up against it. I didn't know that the movie was part of some other kind of situation where they needed to decide also by 5 o'clock to get like everyone above the line to have signed off for some kind of bank loan, something or other, right? Which a composer is a part of that. And he says, you know, it's going to take about 10 months. It's like 80 minutes of score. We need like 15 songs or something like that produced. And it's a dollar. And
oh my God.
Yeah. It's the minimum for a contract at $1. It's 10 months and I'm in debt. And I said, no. And he says, okay, if you change your mind, I have to do it now. We're going to go to the other guy. Hang up the phone. I remember looking at my Panasonic fax phone machine thing. I live above a garage, by the way. And I've got all this stuff all around. I don't have a couch. I don't have a table. And I had just spilled my McDonald's. I like knocked over my drink under my phone. I'm looking at that and I'm looking at the phone. And I remember looking at the clock and realizing there's 87 seconds to decide. And I'm just staring at it and thinking, and my life split, like in my mind, my future. Okay, if I go the corporate thing, I'll be able to start paying off the debt. Do I go with the safe one? No. And I pick up the phone and I dial. I'm like, come on, pick up. I'm in. And that was that. I remember that now as like probably the most pivotal moment of my life.
I don't know how to follow up that great story, but I wonder if... With the series is ostensibly about creative process. And just curious, like, what's the start of your creative process when somebody says, hey, we'd love you to score this film? What's the very start look like? Where do you, start, kind of gathering your inspiration?
I'll kind of give you two examples. So when I'm scoring a film, I read the script and usually I just watch a rough cut of the film and then I go away. And this is the same if I'm writing a theme for Formula One or anything like that. Anytime I always go theme based. So I just kind of take it in and instead of, like on a film, some people just dive into the film and they start writing music. I don't do that. What I do is I want to write music that is like a big suite, like a 15, 20 minute, like a symphony, even if it's modern music for it. And it's going to reflect all the vibe and the narrative and the emotion and thematically hit all the things that you would need to convey a story if you just closed your eyes and you imagined it. And the reason I do that is because if you jump into a scene and you see the main character and I'm going to write the music, there's no background written. You only have maybe like the scene may be you see the character and you want to do a theme, but it would cut off because the scene's too short or whatever. So you kind of end up shoehorning something in and that ends up being the basis of it. I would rather have something that almost exists like outside the film as if it already existed before the film, like as if they are real people. It's kind of like what screenwriters do when they're writing characters that are only on screen for a second, like Lobot from Empire Strikes Back or something. Like he shows up or whatever and he says something, but when you're writing a screenplay, if you really want to invest something into that character, you write a whole backstory. This person grew up over here and he was troubled and then he had this and you kind of have this whole thing. So, and you tell the actor that. So there's something there that feels like it. If I do music like that and I write music outside of it, then it's almost like when I do my first scene, I'm referencing something that already exists that is this person's theme. And I call it like built-in nostalgia. It like feels used. It's like a old suit that fits, So kind of imbues it with something that feels like is genuine. When I'm doing something like Are We Dreaming, which is this wild audio visual concert cinematic experience that I do. So it's like it's music and then it's like a story of like a great scale of the universe and the visuals are following the music, much in a way when my grandfather took me to a double feature of 70 mil print of Fantasia and 2001 A Space Odyssey. And it was such a big impact on me because both those movies are so, well, one thing, Fantasia is music and the animation following the music, right? And then 2001, that entire, with the music and the monolith and the end sequence and the visuals, kind of that influenced me so much that this is kind of like a modern take on those two things put together almost. And so when I'm doing something like that, when I'm writing the music, I'm inverting the process of what I do with film. I'm writing the music first, thinking of the storyline, but then I am doing the visuals to exactly hit every single nanosecond of the music and the movement of it and all the sound. And so it becomes a much more assertive experience, I think, visually in that way, if you do it in reverse. And that's what's cool for me to do both visuals and the music. It makes it so they're very tied in. So I do it from two different angles, depending on what project I'm doing. If I'm doing like a record with like a hip hop artist, like when I was working with like Wiz Khalifa or someone like that, I'll work on the music and the songs before we work on lyrics or vocals, but I'll get a melody in there that's undefined Sometimes you write a structure and then something just clicks. I think the idea is like just providing the basis of something that becomes something bigger in a sense.
We'll return to the conversation after this quick break. Support for Design Better comes from Uplift Desk, creators of office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. It's been estimated that the average person will spend 1/3 of their life at work. Sobering, huh? That's roughly 90,000 hours at work over your lifetime. Imagine what happens to your body if you're working with bad posture and poor circulation. It can be devastating on your health. That's why Eli and I love Uplift Desk and their ergonomic desks and chairs. Uplift Desk makes solid, well-constructed standing desks that you can customize to match your workspace. And they have a wide variety of incredibly ergonomic chairs. My personal favorite is the Human Scale Freedom Chair. I'm sitting in it right now. For professionals like us, investing in the right tools, especially our desk and chair, is essential. You're going to get free shipping, free returns with free return shipping, and an industry-leading 15-year warranty that covers the complete desk. Eli and I love their products, and we know that you will too. Give it a try. Go to upliftdesk.com and use code DESIGNBETTER5 for 5% off your order. That's UPLIFT desk.com to get 5% off your entire order with promo code DESIGNBETTER5.
Support for Design Better comes from our friends at CrashPlan. Visit crashplan.com/designbetter for 50% off your first year of CrashPlan. You may have heard horror stories of people being locked out of their Apple or Google accounts and losing decades worth of precious files like family photos. That's why I've been using CrashPlan for a decade and a half now to back up all my important files. CrashPlan works efficiently in the background while you work, encrypting and sending all your new or changed files up to their secure cloud every 15 minutes. And they make it simple to restore some or all of your data. With unlimited version retention, CrashPlan can also be your ultimate rewind button. Businesses of all sizes benefit from CrashPlan's multi-tenant capabilities. Buy as many user licenses as you need and easily manage them all from under one account. Go to crashplan.com/designbetter for 50% off your first year of CrashPlan. That's crashplan.com/designbetter, all one word, for 50% off your first year. Back up better with CrashPlan.
And now, back to the show.
One of your other interviews, you also said that, and I love that idea of like the music living outside the film and having its own life. And you talked about how Akira Kurosawa sometimes approached movies that way. I'm a big fan of his. I love samurai kind of stories in general, growing up, Seven Samurai, Toshiro Mifune, yeah. all that stuff. Are there other directors in that genre that also inspired you?
For sure. The David Lean and Ridley Scott. How the music and visual relationship, you watch like Zhivago or Lawrence of Arabia and the way the music drives things, or Spielberg, I'm like E.T., the entire last section of E.T. being that when John Williams was conducting it, he was doing it to picture. And then Steven says, let's invert this, just conduct it musically how you want, I'll cut to you. And in a way, that's how I do Are We Dreaming, you know? Of course, like, you know, like the use of electronics, like, and that's why I mentioned Ridley, like with Blade Runner, was like a big influence for me. And then 1492, also, I love that score, also Vangelis, both of those. And then how Kubrick would use found music. That's how I knew Ligeti and Penderecki from, you know, 2001, and then The Shining, finding 20th century, like a Polish avant-garde thing. And that was a big influence on me too. And that Penderecki and all that, and Ligeti and Vangelis. In fact, I have some of my favorite synths I still use, the CS-80s, the Yamaha CS-80s. It's the Blade Runner synth, you know. And it's also cool. Like, I worked with a lot of these people. I've gotten to know a lot of my heroes, you know, like John Williams. Over the years, you know, if it wasn't for John, I probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing, not just as an influence, but because he championed my cause early on, you know, as a composer. And it's been amazing. It was amazing to be a part of his when he was inducted, and he got the Lifetime Achievement Award again in 2017 or whatever, 18 BMI. I was a part of the presenting it and talking about how the generations, and then he called me the next day and was just like, we talked about it. And He goes, you know, something about like, you know, we were talking about how like we both do things that bring something to it and we all stand on the shoulders of giants. And it was like such a big influence in the way. And I didn't know that I would be the next recipient of that same award. And that year, they changed the name when John Williams got it. It used to be the Lifetime Icon Award, the Henry Mancini Award. And they changed the name to be the John Williams Award. And so I was the first Icon Award recipient of the... It's kind of weird that it went from him to me. It's just all these things. And just even, I idolized like Gil Shaham, the violinist. And he was John's concert player, like when you do Schindler's and stuff like that. And he ended up, through John and Gil Shaham ended up being my, when I did my violin concerto, Redeeming Love, recently, he ended up being it because of that. It's just crazy. And then Steven Spielberg, of course, working with him for years. And when I met him and he'd come to my scoring sessions and I remember seeing Steven's thing that he would do where he'd filmed home movies at 1982 at Sony scoring stage of John Williams doing E.T., right, with his black turtleneck. So amazing. And then I was there at the same scoring stage, which they didn't even change. The bike from E.T. is still up, like they have it hanging up on the like in the room. And I'm doing that, and I look over to the left, and I was doing Eagle Eye, which Steven produced. And there he is standing on the scoring stage with his, like, his Amblin hat. Hey, Brian. I was like, what is it? It's like this crazy crossover into just disbelief. But going back to the structure of how it's done, it's funny. It's never changed really in terms of my approach. It's just that I'm always open to learning new things and new kinds of music. And it's like almost like the process is similar. Like, get this, try to like get something that feels like genuine and then build from that. But at the same time, I've never stopped kind of not only standing on the shoulders of giants of the past, but I learn from studying and going back and looking at Leonard Bernstein conducting and how his interpretation of Aaron Copland, as much as someone doing, you know, like a 16-year-old doing some really cool drill beats in a bedroom on a laptop, that I'm like, what is that kind of production he's doing with the sidechain on the compressor? And so like always be open to that, you know?
Yeah. Let's go a little deeper on that. This is fascinating because one of the challenges with the type of work that you're doing is being very culturally aware. You know, if you're scoring a film and the breadth of your work, it covers a lot of different types of genres and emotional situations and so forth. So you have to be aware of different types of sounds, what types of instruments make certain types of sounds, a little bit about like history. And clearly, you know, a lot about musical history. And also culturally, like how music is different, you know, like Western music is actually composed differently and has a different number of tones than Eastern music. Talk to us a little bit about like being connected and staying connected to that intersection of music and culture and the tools required.
Yeah, I mean, I am fascinated with things that sound new to me. The way I guess my brain works or whatever, it's something that kind of would come easy to me is I can quickly deconstruct music all my life. Like I can hear something pretty complex and then kind of just know what it is. And sometimes it'll be like, what is that? And so I got really interested in Eastern music and really into like gamelan and studying that and played in like different ensembles like Balinese and gamelan and all that. But then I got really interested in microtonal music from India and other places. Basically, microtonal music being notes that fall in between the Western scale that would sound wrong, sort of, but unless done with kind of a certain kind of confidence and harmony, then it sounds just amazing, you know, but the wrongness is just because it's foreign to our ear. And I use microtonal, by the way, all the time now. I love introducing people to it and realizing that you can play a piece and if you've never even heard one before, the way you can use it, it's by the end of the piece, you now have a superpower. You've now learned something that has enriched your brain, you know? I was actually did a film about India's partition in World War II in the 40s and from Pakistan. And it was the story of his life growing up in India and all that. And so I went there and discovered a lot of things. You know, I knew about microtonal music and all that, but really became fascinating from a harmonic perspective that to this day I carry and always like trying to like, I sometimes will even play piano and individually record the notes of the piano. So only one of the notes would be sharp by 22%. And I would, every time I would not play the F on that chord because I'd always want that sharp to it. I do stuff like that all the time, right?
Do you change tunings to do that?
Yeah, almost daily. Like when I'm recording, even like when I'm recording for Are We Dreaming, there's a lot of that. Like, and then to have a vocal that is then 22%, it is just, I'm obsessed with it. I was just explaining this weekend to something because I did an Are We Dreaming show that was like a test show. And they're like, what is that? And it did this like bending. They're like, what? And you could see the reaction like, wow, just does this. Like it feels like an intelligence greater than your own kind of thing because it's outside your experience and you hear it and combined with visuals, it's just, oh my God, it's mind bending. Not only that, but for instance, in India, there's something called Konakal, which is, it's a way of learning percussion through vocalization for tabla playing. And kids learn it there very young. And I'm drummer and everything. So I use tabla all over the place and even like those kinds of rhythms a lot, even in like kind of hip hoppy stuff and all that vibe, you know, but also in scoring. The cool thing was, is that like in places like the Gully or like Mumbai or like in kind of more depressed areas economically, the schooling would be that there wouldn't necessarily be enough tablas or whatever. So the kids would learn from a very young age, and they would associate it and they would have to articulate it. The cool thing that's happened kind of in sort of recent history is those kids learn that in school, they go out to the playground and then they battle, kind of like rap battle, right? But with Konakal, but these kids, it's so insanely articulated that their articulation at a very young age is way, way, way beyond that would be here. So now like hip hop artists, like rappers in India are bonkers because they learned at like 4. I mean, like the most, and it's super sick because it's not just articulation, it's also rhythmic. So it's like, and like really sick, like backbeats and stuff. So when I was doing Are We Dreaming and I was just some hip hop tunes and stuff, now I'm like, oh my gosh, that's a huge influence. So I'm like, their record label or whatever is like, who do you want to use for this song? And I'm like, oh, there's this guy in India. So like, that's what I'm doing. It's in Hindi, except it's like, I don't know what they're saying, but I know what they're saying, you know? And so like, I learned from all that. There's such enrichment from different things. Even here's another example, kind of along what we were asking is that, and this goes with anything, art, music, fashion, whatever, whatever, painting. But in music specifically, there's an aesthetic, right? That can sometimes get lost as you get successful because you're recording and it can get homogenized by the system. You get budgets that are not limitless, but like, high budgets on something. For instance, I just encountered this. It was a story where I wanted the emotion of it would be someone that is trying to do something good, but is dehumanized. And there's a choral part to the music. Well, the budget was like, well, why don't you just use the greatest choir in the world to do this part? It could be the London Choir Royal, whatever, right? But no, that's not the right choice for the choir sound. The right choice would be a 1969 Mellotron, which is a tape sampler keyboard that is 1969's best impersonation of a choir. And that sound of not quite being, of trying to be human, that is so much more emotional for that particular piece instead of going for the most expensive whatever. And why hip hop has a sound, like what would happen is you hear an early hip hop record and they're using 808s and Dr. Rhythm stuff because it was some from the street. And it was like, these things were affordable. And it wasn't like big record labels with a bunch of money. And so it had this sound. And then when the big record labels tried to do hip hop, it sounded fake, it sounded whack. Because why? They're like, well, we have the more expensive drum machine. No, you know? Or like I'm going to work on Yellowstone, right? The music of the American West is really music from the immigrants coming here that kind of were looking for something. And they were not typically the wealthy people. So they weren't coming over here with like Stradivarius perfect violins. They came with the cheapies, right? So that's what a fiddle is. So we hear, and like, and it's because they're sitting around the campfire and it's the stuff they brought over. And so like fiddle and that kind of music, you don't want to use the perfection and polish off all the rough edges of that music because the beauty is in the imperfection. And like I always said, you would never auto-tune Etta James. So part of kind of like the growth of like standing on shoulders of giants, but also realizing that it's much more complex than that, from cultures to different kinds of instruments, to jazz, to bass music and drum and bass and choral music and early canonical music to Russian. Like, you look at my studio, it's like balalaikas. I play the koto, I got a sitar, a cello, mandolin, dobro, a berimbau from South America, charango. Like, it's because in any one of these countries or areas or history, there's an 808, here's a Jupiter 8 from 1982 synth, Juno 106. There's these different things. If you go outside the zone of what you know and what you grew up in this little tiny whatever bubble you're in, burst the bubble and kind of really go outside it, you're going to enrich yourself and your art and life, really.
Yeah, Brian, could you talk a bit, sort of hinting at these different, it's almost like a lack of constraints in some sense, like you're dealing with really big budgets and writing for film, there's not that many limitations. In the course of your process, do you kind of set any rules for yourself or anything that sort of maybe creates artificial constraints and help you get more creative?
Yeah, I give myself the five restrictions. It's like sometimes when I'm doing something, well, always, you want to find a tonal palette. So sometimes I'll do a film like Escape Room or something. And I remember on that, I was like, okay, what I want to do is, because of the tone of what that is, I'm only going to use synthesis, but outboard synthesizers that are after 1983 back to 72. I think it's an 11-year stretch, even though it wasn't from that era. So it was like, I think the earliest synth I used was the ARP 2600. And then the Juno 106 from 83, or Juno 60. Anyway, so it was like strict, right? And also recording technique had to be a certain amount of tracks. You couldn't use just infinite tracks. That's kind of an obvious way to limit yourself, but also you can creatively limit yourself. Like, I'm only going to use Mixolydian kind of scales and whatever, you know. But instrumentation-wise, it is very clear what that limitation would be. Or I've done this twice. And the other direction, so like Crazy Rich Asians, where it was jazz and a traditional score, I wanted to be where that's a score I could have recorded in 1940. And then there's a piece in Are We Dreaming that's this song, and it's like a banger of like a hip-hop kind of like bass music, except that like right at the beginning it says, this next song is all recorded with instruments that could have been recorded in 1457. And so the sub bass is a pipe organ sub, and then the drums and everything like that were ones from there. And it sounds like a festival, like, banger. It really does. And people are fascinated with, like, how does it sound like that? Like, so it's basically, the advantage we have isn't just technology. The advantage we have as people right now, to be privileged to be living now in the most recent, is that we have all the knowledge that we could have gained, and you can use that. It's kind of the restrictions kind of open up a creativity flow that is, to me, very, very necessary. I think also what happens is there's an error that people make all the time because of Pro Tools and even in sound effects mixing in a movie or music, where they just put too much stuff in. It's just blah, and it's layered, and they somehow think that more is better. And it doesn't work that way. You just crowd it, and then the stuff that was cool and popped before now is hidden. And it just becomes too much. And it's like, it doesn't matter how many speakers you have in the ceiling and Atmos and all that stuff that really is kind of nonsense. We have two ears. There's only two. We don't have 47 ears. So you're just hearing it this way. So just mix it so it sounds good. It's just really funny that, like, now we have 5 billion tracks and we can do 7 zillion different sounds at one time. And I'm like, that's great. Do you think movies sound better now than they did in the 70s? It's kind of one of those things to be also wary of the non-limitations of technology, but at the same time, embracing the stuff that it can do. I was as a drummer, there was a session drummer. The advent of drum machines and programming come around. I remember a lot of drummers were like, it was almost like they were at a car factory where here come the robots to take our jobs, right? It's automated. And I was not that way. I was like, yeah, but it does something different. So I got into programming drums at the same time as a drummer. It was like one of the few, like, kind of to not knee jerk. While you have to be kind of understanding that you don't want to go uncanny valley with certain things, like with the visuals, like where CGI, they kind of got ahead of their skis, where you'd see a character and you'd be like, ew, that's weird. You know, it's not quite there yet. You don't want to use technology to the point where it's just like overused, but at the same time embracing it.
Yeah, all that resonates with us and our audience because design is definitely having a similar event right now. It's not drum machines, it's generative AI. And
oh, I know.
Yeah, and there are those who are afraid of it and those who embrace it.
Yeah, and I'm both. So I work in Blender and Unreal Engine and all that because I render visual effects. So I'm designing huge shots of space stations and planets and wormholes and also buildings and down to the wireframe and all that. And this the AI thing, and it's in music too. So I see it from both sides. It is alarming to me in that the sense is that to me, it would never be as creative or interesting. It's almost like if you went to a country that was healthy, that had never experienced processed sugar and stuff, and you just dumped a bunch of Twinkies on them. At first, you're like, wow, look at that visual. But the problem is that, of course, it's just scanning things that human beings have created and smushing them together. And it can be amazing in moments, but you realize it's going to cannibalize itself. It's not actually something that's a new thing. So you have to have those human beings that do the hard work that put it out there. But the problem is of just kind of scanning the internet and without giving any credit or anything, just kind of Borg shipping it and assimilating it and spitting it back out. The fear that I have is that it's not that it'll be better. It's that it's easier. So you don't want it to be that at some point someone is, for instance, releasing 300 really, really mediocre albums per day that drown out the actual human being, one that no one hears that's way, way, way better. Or visually, with design, flooding the market with something that just makes it so there's too much noise, there's just too many things. With all the millions of hours that are uploaded to YouTube, for instance, it's kind of the same thing. You want it to be that there is some kind of way to make it so it's not just randomized, because it kind of gives people that don't really have a voice to kind of put something out there that is quote art. It's complicated, but at the same time, I use a lot of technology to make sound better, or even the fact that I can do these visuals for Are We Dreaming is something that I only could do in the modern era. It's not AI, but it is technology. I think the handoff comes when the human being doesn't have really anything to do with it. And then I'm like, I'm not feeling that.
Brian, where can people learn more about you, your work? Are We Dreaming? I can't wait to see that. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's going to be at the end of the year here coming up. I would say briantyler.com. You go there. Just kind of keeping up with me, like also what's coming out and stuff like that. There's going to be Are We Dreaming pages and whatnot over time. But Brian Tyler Music on Instagram too. That kind of, I do updates there as well. But, and then of course, for music, you go to Spotify or any streaming service and find me there, and YouTube as well. I have a channel there that has a lot of my concert work, and you can see me recording session and playing drums and all sorts of things on the YouTube page.
That's fantastic. Brian, you're amazing. What a treat to talk to you.
Right on. Back at you. That was fun.
Have you seen the new MacBook Air? Oh man, they are so fast. They're super light and they are beautiful. And we're giving one away to a lucky winner. To enter to win the new MacBook Air, all you have to do is complete our listener survey. Tell us a bit about you and share your feedback about the show. It'll help us improve, and you could soon be enjoying a brand new MacBook Air. To take the survey, visit dbtr.co/2024survey. That's dbtr.co/2024survey, and you'll automatically be entered to win. We'll randomly select a winner on Friday, March 1st, so be sure to complete the survey by then.
This episode was produced by Eli Woolery and me, Aaron Walter, with engineering and production support from Brian Paik of Pacific Audio. If you found this episode useful, we hope that you'll leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to finer shows. Or simply drop a link to the show in your team's Slack channel, designbetterpodcast.com. It'll really help others discover the show. Until next time.